As the Yukon Pod evolves, it becomes necessary to expand our horizons, bring some people on board, and try and bring some of those interesting conversations to y'all in our weekly update. And so I'm very pleased for my podcast listeners to have the very first guest of our weekly podcast segment be someone whose writing I've enjoyed very much over the past few years. You may know him on Twitter as Bobby Big Wheel. He has written for SB Nation, Vice, Deadspin. You can find him all over the web. Bobby, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. You know, I'm a former CCC athletic participant, so I grew up cheering for UConn in all things. I ended up not going to the school because I didn't want to do 13th grade, but I still have a vested interest in the team, and it's really nice to be on a UConn-oriented show and a college-oriented show.
Awesome. Well, we're really excited to have you, and I think I'm really excited to kind of talk a little bit more about some of the things more broadly going on in the world of college sports. Most notably, this past weekend, I think we had a pretty interesting scenario go down in Ohio State. JT Barrett arrested Saturday morning, you know, depending on what you want to call it, for driving under the influence, suspended for one game by Ohio State, but then has also had his scholarship revoked, which of course brought sports Twitter into a frenzy.
To be fair, it doesn't take much to put sports Twitter into a frenzy.
Yeah, that is true. But I think, you know, what was interesting about this was that, you know, people were pretty divided about it. You know, some felt it was a fair punishment. And I think some of the more reasonable people, some of the people who tend to side with the players in these types of issues, felt like, you know, how can you say all the things you say about the student athlete relationship when they can lose their scholarship, you know, for a legal transgression?
Yeah, and so there are people who can't see the writing on the wall, and that. Really, you know, once TV money really started swimming around in college football, it was going to become inevitable that players would have to receive cash compensation of some amount. You just have right now this discrepancy between what the players receive and what, like, the coaches and the administrators receive, and it just becomes untenable after a while to have that discrepancy. So, you know, the people that are trying to prevent this from ever happening, even as the money keeps getting larger and larger, the excuse for it is, well, you know, they're paid with an education. They're paid with a scholarship. You know, I wanted a scholarship, blah, blah, blah. You know, that ignores the fact that, you know, the people who are making these points didn't offer to the school the value that these players do. And so this kind of underscores really how, well, you know, even if they aren't receiving cash compensation, it's a very tenuous amount of cash compensation. And, you know, the revoking of the scholarship. Now, I've heard that Ohio State's on a quarter system, so it's not quite as egregious as you might think. But still, you know, really, without any due process, J.C. Barrett has had a benefit taken away from him. And I'm a lawyer, and I look at that, in a normal labor context, that would be an actionable thing. But because the players don't have this collective bargaining power, they're really left out to dry in situations exactly like this.
Yeah, and I think another one of the objections is that, don't you know that college athletics programs lose money hand over fist, and there's just no money to pay the players? And then meanwhile, like you said, coaches' salaries go up. These lavish palaces, of football complexes are being built. They're funding an entire athletics program, 20 plus other sports, but there's no money for the players who generate that income.
Yeah, that's funny. Now, the next time someone tells you that these athletic programs need money, I tell them, all right, explain to me the difference between capital expenditures and operating expenditures. And you realize pretty soon that they just have no idea how a balance sheet works. I mean, by very definition, you know, they're probably going to, you know, on the books, you're going to break even. And you're going to find, you know, if you give an athletics department $30 million, they're going to find a way to spend $30 million. So, yeah, it's really just where are we allocating this money? And you have a $5 million coach's salary and, again, this type of in-kind handle cash for education. Maybe that's denigrating it a little bit, but, you know, it really, like you said, it highlights kind of just how schools are really, you know, exploiting these players for capital gains.
Absolutely. And then, I mean, we've seen so many different ways that a scholarship can be taken away from a player. You mentioned that it's a quarterly system, so it's not, you know, it's not super strong. And I mean, there's probably a likelihood that some booster is paying his tuition anyway. That definitely wouldn't surprise me, but, something about taking that scholarship away, when it's the only thing that he has, you know, altogether, it's you have this one unit of scholarship versus an amount of money, you know, that you can find someone or what have you. It's just one of those things where every other business doesn't work like this. So hopefully they do see the writing on the wall and, I mean, we had the situation that the Northwestern ruling was overturned. Were you following that saga at all?
You know, I was following it loosely, and it is a setback for this movement because this is something where, you know, I think that some people really can make the case that this kind of in-kind compensation that the players achieve from scholarship, it might actually be permissible in a system where, I mean, you can basically have them go out to boosters and be like, all right, pay me extra money. You know, they're not getting it from the school or, you know, appearance fees or selling their jerseys or some other kind of other compensation outside of scholarship. But that doesn't address really, and I want to put this, the biggest issue is that they just have no leverage to negotiate. And, you know, if you look at, for example, in the NFL, I mean, imagine a team suspending a player for your DUI one game, but revoking 4 or 6 or 8 games with the paychecks, depending on, you know, I guess what the size of, you know, what Ohio State's term system is. But it really highlights the fact that, you know, hey, there's an NFLPA that can go to bat for these players. They can collectively bargain. They're organized, and with college players, you just don't have that. And what the NCAA is trying to do is a very noble thing, but the NLRB ruling really harms that, and that in turn just highlights the fact that, well, maybe the NLRB is wrong, and these guys do need collective bargaining.
Yeah, I mean, there's an NFLPA. How effective and organized they actually are is definitely up for debate. But I think there's another element of this. You know, you bring up the pro leagues. Aren't they somewhat complicit as well? I mean, it's kind of the NFL's 3-year ruling that really gives, you know, football players coming out of high school really no other option. And it's one of those things where they constantly say, you know, oh, you have other options. You can play, you know, in the instance of college basketball, you can play in the D League. You can play in Europe. This insistence that there are other options, but isn't it really? Don't the NFL and NBA play a role by having their various age restrictions?
Yeah, they do. And actually, the reason why those aren't antitrust violations is because they're collectively bargained. So not only do the league bear some responsibility, but actually the Players Association really bear some responsibility here, because they really, you know, if the player associations were able to, you know, bargain these out of the collective bargaining agreement, say, you know, a guy like Leonard Fournette can just come into the league whenever he wants, you know, they would be really helping the people that had been in their opposition. But you have this real issue here where the people in the NFLPA, they don't really have agency over the college players. there's no constituency within the NFLPA that's really clamoring to get rid of this rule, and that you kind of have this constant churn of the people who have to spend 3 years playing college ball, where it becomes very difficult from just a logistics standpoint to get someone to stand up for these players within kind of the labor process that could, you know, eventually remediate this. It's really unfortunate, and you know, not again, it really highlights the need for a separate labor organization for college players, because there really isn't anyone with legal power advocating for them right now.
Yeah, and it is really disappointing that the players are not on their side. Like you said, they were in that situation before, but now, if you are a 5-year veteran or a 7-year veteran, you're in that situation where you're thinking for yourself, and you don't want more people to be eligible who can potentially take that, you know, that roster spot from you. So it becomes a situation where if your fellow players don't also have your interests in mind, you know, despite the fact that they're in the pros, it's a problem. And it, you know, it's unfortunate because it seems like pro sports is really a zero sum game. You either make it to the top and become ultra successful, you know, or you never get there at all. And you kind of flail along the way and deal with real poverty and problems if it doesn't go well.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess the issue there is, you know, the NFLPA, I don't think, even though, I mean, they are kind of throwing the college players out by allowing them to stay in, you know, what if the owners come to them and say, all right, well, we'll knock it down to 2 years, but you get less of a revenue share. I mean, you know, it's a very tough sell. And I mean, when it comes to, again, collective bargaining, you know, one of the pitfalls of that is that it can become, you know, unions in general can become, you know, kind of advocating for all working people. It's really just people who have their specific circumstances. And if you look at the labor movement, when they became ossified, you had them, you know, really just trying to keep a cabal going instead of advocating more broadly for worker growth. And, you know, so, again, it's a pretty tough problem to solve. We're not going to solve it here on the podcast, unfortunately. But, you know, again, it goes back to, you know, the players need collective bargaining. And the NLRB needs to regain a split, or the courts, I think, I forget who overturned that. But, you know, JT Baird is really a poster child for some of the, you know, the real issues facing college players.
And then another component of that, you know, the system that this kind of systematic cartel that they have, is that you have these coaches who are, you know, demigods within their region, and basically have a dictator's power over, you know, at least an athletic department and maybe even a school.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, again, it goes back to the earlier point of, you know, when you're giving these athletic departments all this money, they're going to find a way to use it. And you're right, it ends up being used, you know, to kind of god up these coaches, essentially. And, you know, you don't see that really in other pro sports. I mean, the NBA, that really doesn't happen. The NFL, it does, I think, just because, you know, of teams are larger, so there's kind of naturally seen as more of a need for it, and they're more regimented, less free flowing, so you see the coach's hands more readily. But like in basketball and baseball and hockey, it's really the play seen as the player's sport. And you know, and I guess the starkest difference is really college basketball and NBA, where, you know, the college players, especially with the 1-year rule, I mean, they're seen as, you know, very ephemeral, and it's really seen as a coaching sport. And so these coaches can kind of demand, you know, instead of the money going to these players that deserve it, it goes to the coaches who might not.
Yeah, and right, these, and then it's why it's so hard to believe these coaches who have, especially in a basketball team, who have this kind of unilateral power, to then say when something is going wrong within a corner of your program, whether it is academic or recruiting compliance, cough, Syracuse, Louisville, cough, cough. You know, then they're completely in the dark. They say, I had no idea that any of this was happening. You know, how realistic is that? And how dumb do they think, you know, the average person is to say that as their response when something like the Louisville scandal goes down or the Syracuse academic impropriety?
Yeah, and Louisville, I mean, it really, I mean, you know, that athletic director, hey, he's done a great job of really, you know, he has really been able to monetize the program very well, but we're seeing now it's really at the expense of, you know, really student athletes. He was the guy who's basically like, now we're just going to play weekday games to get more exposure. Sorry, players, you know, we're making it even more of a farce separating this from education. And then, of course, I mean, his two big-ticket coaches that he hires are Rick Pitino, who, I guess, you know, when he was hired, I mean, he was known as, as people who have been around the Northeast for a while, we know that Rick Pitino didn't always have a sterling reputation. But the real scandal and stuff, I think, didn't come out until he had already been at Louisville. But, you know, rehiring Bobby Petrino, I mean, how transparent is that?
Unreal.
And then the message that you said against all the women at Louisville, yeah, these are the guys that they're putting in front of the program. You know, all the women on campus, these are the guys that they're putting in charge. And and then this scandal comes out, and it's like, you know, let's say Rick Pitino didn't know that this was happening. At the very least, you know, maybe this goes to the atmosphere that's been created at the Louisville Athletic Department, because it obviously, you know, I can't imagine that that's a very good workplace for women.
Right, exactly. I mean, with the Pitino situation, you rehire that guy. First of all, after the way he left Louisville, after the way he left Atlanta, and then the way he had to leave Arkansas, you know, for you to just take him back like that, says a lot about what your values are, and kind of like you said, this does not show well for the entire university as a whole. So, go ahead.
Now, and another thing on the Pitino hire, too, is that if you look back at the contemporaneous news stories on him, you know, Louisville was seen as really a good place to coach. You were seen as having a lot of resources. Charlie Strong was a good recruiter, so you had talent there. And they really had their pick of any, you know, I would say of any coach on the market, but there were a lot of up-and-coming coaches who would have taken that job and would have done a good job. And to go to Pitino was just such, like, you know, and again, this is a UConn podcast, so I have to bring this up, but it's like, if you're the ACC and you see them do that, you know, are you having second thoughts on this?
Oh, I mean, of course, you don't have to, you don't have to explain jumping there, because that's exactly what we're inclined to do, is to say, look, ACC, you sold out completely. You talk about being all about academics, and then you add the commuter school in Kentucky, brought to you by KFC. So you know, definitely a huge contradiction that does not look good for them. And you're right, very, very good point that they could have brought in. There were a number of very, very good up-and-coming coaching candidates that they could have gone to, you know, rather than the massive, massive PR hit they took from bringing on Bobby Petrino and everything that comes with it.
Yeah, and, you know, and it's really sad, just looking at how everything went down, because all the realignment stuff happened. And I would say the windows between the hiring of Paul Pasqualoni, the people are like, what the hell are you doing? And Louisville hiring Bobby Petrino, and people are being like, what the hell are you doing? That, I think, was the window for Louisville to overtake UConn.
So the Paul Pasqualoni hire is really, in, you know, it's hard to imagine a worse hire for a football program in terms of, you know, the effect that it has on the coming decades. I mean, can you think of anyone else in history where really, you know, if they, I mean, who knows if what Mark Whipple could have done? It had to be better than that. And it's just, you know, if Paul Pasqualoni cost them the ACC, can you think of a worse possible coaching hire in the past 20 years?
No, absolutely not. And I think it's just the worst part about the Pasqualoni hire, you know, besides, like you are pointing out, that it may very well have cost UConn a bid into the ACC, is that it was just so uninspired or uninspiring from the get-go, that no UConn fan was excited about that news. They viewed the hire, you know, almost as like, I'm not the biggest baseball fan, but like bunting with runners on second and third and no outs or something like that.
Yeah.
Where,
no, and, you know, I had friends around the program, nothing particularly insightful, but I knew people around it. And I mean, it was, you know, everyone was really kind of dumped. I mean, it was really a very, you know, I think the reasoning at the time was that he was going to keep on a lot of Ed Saul's old staff or something like, you know, he wouldn't try to bring in his own people. So it'd end up costing less. And, you know, you talk about penny wise, pound foolish. How many millions of dollars is having a bad football coach going to cost them? And then, you know, you look at who UConn was interviewing versus who was really kind of the high commodities in the coaching market then. And there really is a huge disconnect. I mean, it was Paul Pasqualoni and Mark Whipple were the last two candidates. I mean, Mark Whipple, he's back at UMass. He seems to be doing well. But, you know, a few years ago, he spent the year out of football because, you know, no one really wanted to hire him.
Yeah. I mean, you could argue that, and I will, actually, that because it hasn't been that long, UConn is still paying for the Paul Pasqualoni era.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, when you talk about the average fan, you know, they're still not very, and rightfully so, for if you're talking about an average fan, average observer, mostly likes to see the basketball teams win. You know, they still are feeling the collective suckiness of the past 5 years.
Yeah.
And those 5-7 Pasqualoni seasons, you know, that were, you know, even worse than bottoming out with young people. It was just kind of intentional mediocrity is what you got from Paul Pasqualoni.
Yeah.
It was very, very disappointing.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, though, with Bob Diaco, I think that was, you know, it was a very good hire. I think it was kind of almost the opposite of the Pasqualoni thing, where you had a guy, he won the Broyles Award for the top assistant 2 years before. The guy who'd won it the year before, Pat Narduzzi, turned UConn down. You know, so I mean,
allegedly,
you know, Pat Narduzzi. What? Pardon?
Allegedly.
Allegedly, of course. you know, but I think, you know, look back at who won the Broyles Award when Ed Saul left, and you know, were they turning down UConn then? I don't know. You know, it might not have been the geographic fit, but we'll see. But no, but Diaco, he was a fit in all the right ways. He's obviously an intense guy.
Yeah.
I think, you know, he really coached some very, you know, coached some very good defenses at Notre Dame, and he does have an energy. You know, I think the Pasqualoni era could be categorized by lethargy, and Diaco is the opposite of that. And I have seen, again, you know, I'm not in Connecticut, but all my family and friends, you know, a lot of them are, and there seems to be at least some kind of buzz around the UConn football team that just wasn't there in the years before.
Is there a palpable buzz around UConn football?
I mean, palpable buzz, when I say that, I mean people actually in Connecticut. I would say, no, I mean people that, I have a lot of friends who went there. I have family that went there. You know, and again, you know, I am somewhat an outsider because I decided not to go there. But that said, I noticed them caring about the football team a little more now. Just, it seems like Diaco at least has them being talked about, when really the Pasqualoni is just an afterthought.
Yeah, and you know, something else that's really encouraging is that, you know, tracking recruiting very closely, the football recruiting seems to be going very well.
Yeah, and that's always, I mean, that's the toughest part of the job at UConn is, you know, recruiting and getting the fans to care. I mean, it's something. I think it's one of the reasons why you need a guy like a high energy guy like Diaco, because if you have kind of less of a schmoozer, a guy like, you know, maybe a guy like Narduzzi, who doesn't seem to be as effusive, would be a he wouldn't be as good of a fit. Whereas you kind of need a promoter like Diaco now, even though, you know, I guess Edsel was never like that, but I think he didn't need to sell the program the way that it needs to be sold right now, now that they're in the American Conference.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a different situation. With Edsel, it was, we're making this move up and, be that solid presence to take us there. And, I mean, people kind of forget this in the whole aftermath of how Edsel left, but, you know, there were people who were even calling for Edsel to leave or be fired, because they were bored of 7-5 and 3 yards in a cloud of dust and that kind of thing. And little did we know how bad it could really get, with those seasons after he left. But I think I'm very for Bob Diaco and what he's doing. I believe that this season is going a lot better than expected.
Absolutely.
I think you could have made a very good argument that if you polled 100 college football writers, you know, at least half of them probably would have had Villanova beating UConn in that season opener. And I think beating ECU this past Friday night was a really great statement, especially after the way that the Cincinnati game had gone the previous week.
Yeah, and I mean, and further to that point, I mean, it's also good for the way that the American has really busted out. And even if UConn really isn't one of the emergent teams, you know, it does, it's like, hey, this isn't, you know, we're not playing in the old Yankee Conference. This is, you know, these are people playing good football. It's, you know, they're competing on, if not the highest level, a very high level. And, you know, and then that's something else that you can sell to recruits. You know, it's like, oh, okay, well, and so we're, you know, I imagine we're recruiting mostly against ACC and Big Ten schools for most of these guys, that, you know, at least the upper level guys that we want to get. And, it's, you know, you can sit on the bench for, you know, Penn State or whatever. Or you can come to UConn, you can play right away, and you're not playing nobodies. I mean, the scouts are going to see you, so, you know, come on over. So, you know, this season has been a good one for UConn in a lot of aspects, and there's optimism around that program that hasn't existed for a while.
Yeah, I mean, we're in Bob Diaco's second season, you know, inheriting the entire mess that we talked about with Paul Pasqualoni, and he's got the team at 4 wins, and has people talking about a bowl game, you know, which nobody was, you know, there's some people maybe, but very, very few people were thinking that this UConn team was bowl bound at the beginning of the season.
And another thing, Bill Connolly, for SB Nation, he says kind of with coaches, the first year is basically year zero. Like, it almost doesn't count because, you know, they're coming into a situation where they had no control over how things were. I mean, Diaco said he was like, you know, the whole thing was just a total mess when he came in. There was no real pride in the program. He had to spend the first year just kind of like connecting all the loose ends. And now this is his first year really with like his team. It's not even all his players. It's still mostly guys Pasqualoni recruited. But, you know, the team is kind of used to the system that he runs. And the fact that it's all kind of exceeding expectations already, I think, and then as he kind of ramps up, if UConn does really well, you know, there's no talent. I mean, you see the turn at the top of college football and the NFL too, which leads to a turn in college football as well. You know, eventually there's a good chance that Diaco would get hired away, but, you know, for a school like UConn, you're hoping that the system he leaves in place, there can be someone who can kind of take that over and run with it.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where people were saying that right when he got hired, like, oh my gosh, this guy, he's such a hot prospect. You know, how long is he going to even stay at UConn? And my thinking is, if he's in a position, if he comes in inheriting the situation that he has, and he's in a position where other people want to hire him, that means something great happened for UConn. So I'll take it. I'll definitely take it if that's the case. But to quickly close out some of our conversation about earlier, about Louisville, UNC, Syracuse, you're a lawyer. So I wanted to get your sense for what do you think, and maybe you want to do them individually quickly, what do you think are actual appropriate punishments for Syracuse, Louisville, and the University of North Carolina?
Yeah, I mean, well, they're each individual. I mean, you know, I actually think a legalistic response to all of those really isn't necessary. I mean, it's, you know, because, you know, maybe I'm being a bit too much of a stan here, but, you know, a legal system kind of depends on processes that have been thought through and, you know, I try to deal in a, you know, with my work in a way that's, you know, somewhat transparent about dealing with the environment we are. And, you know, all these scandals, each one of them kind of hinges on this lie that college sports tell about themselves, about, you know, these are amateurs, they're student athletes, you know, it's all about them getting an education, and, you know, oh, we can't pay them. If that didn't create this kind of black market, if you will, for their labor, where you have to give non-salary inducements, and that's what all of these scandals really derive out of, you know, then this doesn't happen. So, I mean, the legalistic response is to do away with this black market and put in place a system where, you know, again, you just pay them more. And, you know, there's no such thing as a recruiting scandal in pro sports because everyone there's a professional. If you want someone to play for you more, you don't have to make classes easier or offer a prostitute or whatever. You just pay them more. So that's my response. It's not punishing the coaches. It's paying the players.
That's very good. Go buy your own prostitute with the money.
Exactly.
If you are so inclined. But
at UNLV, it's possible. Or I guess Nevada, because it's not legal in Clark County. But, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and then, and you know, the other thing about, just to go back to the paying the players, is that, okay, fine, you have such a huge problem, they have to fill out 6 tax forms, okay, maybe the school doesn't pay the player, why can't they go out and make money? Why can't a local auto dealership sign, you know, the starting quarterback to a sponsorship deal? What is keeping him from... What is harming the game when he makes that money for being as high profile of a person as he is?
Yeah, no, and it goes back to that lie about these guys being amateurs and how doing that to the, you know, to the NCAA, America's greatest mall cop, this is circumventing the system that they put in place to make sure these guys don't pay money. And I think now that, again, you know, the system... You know, I mean, again, it's been exploited from the start. You know, Taylor Branch had a thing, we did that. But what really kind of supercharged the exploitation was just this influx of TV money. And it just makes the impossible current, you know, it makes it impossible for the current situation to hold. So I think that'll actually be the first thing that happens, is that, you know, they'll be like, all right, there can be a system where they can get like appearance fees and all these types of ancillary benefits. And I think we'll have the NCAA will try to put limits on that, and it's just those limits will be, the second that you put those in place, teams are going to push those to the limit. And eventually, this center will crumble, and these guys will start getting paid, because, again, you're just creating this black market, and it leads to, you know, in the end, it'll just be easier to pay the guys.
Yeah. Well, you know, the reason I wanted, I wanted some heavy-handed punishments doled out to UNC, Syracuse, Louisville, even, is, of course, as you will recall, the University of Connecticut men's basketball team was hit with a pretty hard, pretty harsh penalty, and of having to miss, again, it's kind of one of those, like, historic things where they were banned from the NCAA tournament, but they also missed the final actual Big East tournament in 2013, which was a real shame. You know, when you think about UConn's contribution to that conference, the school that won the most Big East regular season and tournament championships, not being able to play in that final one, and to have it be something that those players there never had anything to do with, and to have it be this APR thing where they, as people like to say, like move the foul line back and then not count everything, the foul shot that was made at the previous line after the fact. So, you know, after being hit with that harsh penalty, I mean, obviously it was an amazing moment the following year for Shabazz to lead the team to the championship, openly bring that up to the crowd. This is what happens when you ban us. You know, one of the greatest moments in all time UConn history. And then followed that season up, unfortunate, you know, with a little bit of a step back, but, I don't know if you've been following it so closely, but it looks like UConn is primed for a big season. They've added a graduate transfer from Cornell, who has looked very good. They added Sterling Gibbs from Seton Hall, and they're still returning Amita Brima, the big shot blocker, Rodney Purvis, the big-time playmaker, former McDonald's All-American, and Daniel Hamilton, who was absolutely stellar last year as a freshman. Are you getting pumped for the start of basketball season?
You know, I mean, when I was living in Connecticut, I would have been all on top of all of that. I think I found as once I left the state, UConn basketball became a more all right. Once football's over, all right, time for UConn basketball again. So I'm excited to start following it in February. But no, it is even though I didn't go there. And, you know, I still retain my affinity for that basketball team. There were so many great moments. I think back, you know, to 1999 when I was 14 years old, the Whalers had just left. And, you know, we were all kind of down about sports. And then Khalid Al-Amin, my favorite player of all time, helps lead. All right, also, Rip Hamilton was the leader there, but he was the soul of that team, leading the team to the title. So, you know, I can't forget moments like that, you know, and then you have, you know, the 2014, the 2009 team, and of course, the 2011 team, I should say, and the 2014 team, all just, you know, very fond memories of all of them. And I'm really hoping for another special year from them because I know how much that team means to the state and how much it means to, you know, it means more to a lot of people who are close to me. So I'm definitely, you know, really primed for a good UConn basketball season because the world's a happier place when UConn's feeling well.
And you know, the thing is with men's basketball is that's where we're feeling the conference situation a lot harder, I would say, than in football.
Yeah.
Because when we're talking about not having games anymore with not just Syracuse, Pittsburgh, you know, but also then the Catholic schools, right? Georgetown, yeah. Villanova, even Providence and St. John's were frisky in their own right at times.
There was a lot of history there, and I don't want to sound, you know, again, I don't want to sound like an old saw or anything. Because hey, I mean, yeah, they did that whole ESPN miniseries on how great it was before UConn was any good. I guess so, but yeah. I mean. Yeah, there was, you know, I don't know how much at this point an 18-year-old recruit really cares about those, but I know at least for the fans they do. And I imagine that there is, especially within the Northeast, you know, the memories of maybe, you know, like Allen Iverson at Georgetown, I think is one that for a lot of people remembered that. And, you know, before him it was Patrick Ewing, but I think for my generation, I think Allen Iverson kind of defined Georgetown for a while. Even though he wasn't there that long, and just, you know, losing those connections, I think, you know, UConn's become a bit unmoored, but they're also in a conference that, you know, there are a lot of teams in our current conference who have played good basketball in the past. So I think, you know, hopefully, it can build toward new rivalries and, you know, a new kind of paradigm where 18-year-olds are going to be like, oh, yeah, they play good basketball in the American.
Yeah, and I like to kind of equate it actually a lot. It's a lot like the Big East when it just started. You know, you had a bunch of schools that were not very good playing regularly against a bunch of schools that were better, and those schools that were at the bottom were able to raise their play. And UConn was one of those schools which was a beneficiary of that. And I think the role that the next step in the evolution of your athletic program is that you are then the big fish, you know, letting other programs, build on the shoulders of yours. Tulane basketball now gets to say, we play UConn twice a year. And that's great for them. They say, now we get to play SMU twice a year, which kind of became sort of good. Cincinnati, Memphis, those are big, big jumps for those schools at the bottom, but especially UConn, obviously the four-time national champion. So we're going to close us out here because I've taken up a little too much of your time here, but, one thing that every UConn men's basketball fan that's on their mind, basically from the start of every offseason is going to be, if it seems like we have to deal with it every offseason, is if Kevin Ollie leaves for the NBA. Do you think that's a imminent move?
You know, I can't predict Kevin Ollie's mind. I think it's something that it automatically becomes fun to speculate about, but that, you know, ultimately it's just one man's decision. And, you know, we were all kind of very nervous about what would happen after Calhoun left, and Kevin Ollie showed that he had the ability to keep things going after Calhoun left. And so I think that rather than fretting about all this speculation, just kind of enjoy the moment and be confident that when Kevin Ollie leaves, because he's not going to be there forever, believe it or not, there'll be someone else who can take his place, and UConn has a system in place to ensure that good basketball is played in stores.
Yeah, I got to think the family will take care of that. And our athletic director has proven to be pretty adept at hiring coaches, it would seem.
Yeah.
Not only, bringing in Diaco, extending Ollie, but even our men's ice hockey hire, which was of critical importance moving into Hockey East, to grab the associate head coach from Boston College, and the program has been doing incredible. Hockey's back in Hartford. I don't know if
I know. I think I might actually go the next time I'm home, just because the Wolfpack never did do it for me, unfortunately, after the Whalers left. So I'm going to try to see if college hockey can do it for me. I'm going to go back to our old seats in Section 301 at the Civic Center and watch some hockey.
Yeah, no, it's a lot of fun. I've been going to the games this year. We cover all of them live. Definitely be sure to say hi if you do.
Absolutely.
But they're a real good time. They play Brass Bonanza when UConn scores, and that's happening more and more often. There's some real NHL talent on the UConn roster now, which is
that's amazing.
Yeah, which is really, really exciting. So
yeah, and I think with the Wolfpack, I think one of the reasons why is because you could tell those guys weren't. I mean, sometimes you would have a guy come in. Like I remember when Mike York had like a little cup of coffee with the Wolfpack, and he just played out of his mind because he was so much more talented. I think the up and coming young talented guys, that could really, I think, we can make Hartford a hockey town again if that keeps happening.
Yeah, definitely. Well, listen, I'm at the edge of my studio time now, so that's going to have to do it for us. I'm just going to do a quick sign off, and then thank you so much. But
hey, you're welcome. I love talking with you.
Great. And yeah, I really enjoyed the conversation as well. This is Amon Kidwai for Bobby Big Wheel from the UConn Pod. Thank you all for listening. You still there? Thank you.